Rachel Grimm, and welcome to the podcast With All Your Mind. I'm here to help us understand the Bible with cultural and historical context, linguistic info, and other cool stuff. Enjoy. All right. Good afternoon, guys. This is Rachel, and this is With All Your Mind. And I'm glad you're back. This is one of those episodes that made me think for about 2 months, I should really record more podcast episodes. So I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're here to hear it. Otherwise, what am I doing? But anyway, we have been talking about the kind of distinctive style and features of Hebrew writing. And if you haven't listened to the past two episodes, I would highly recommend it. It will just help you to understand the kind of things that we're talking about. Season one was not that linear. You could listen to pretty much any old episode in season one, and it was fine. Season two, very linear. It had a progression. It built off of itself. And season three, it's mostly similar in that it's going to build off of itself, and the last episode isn't going to make too much sense unless you listen to the other ones. So listen to these ones in order. Listen to the last two episodes if you haven't already, episodes 2 and 3 of season 3. But yeah, you should listen to these ones in order. It'll help. So all of this talking about Hebrew, the style of Hebrew, and the features of Hebrew are not intended to make you feel like if you don't know Hebrew, you don't understand the Bible. That is not the point. And if you get that point, or you know, that's what you take away, I'm sorry. No, that is not the point. The point is that all of literature, no matter where it's written or when it's written, is going to have features from its culture. And I've just been thinking lately that I'm not a language person. I'm a culture and language person. I love linking the two together because they go together. And there's I'll always remember a linguistics professor in college telling us about how there are two different branches of linguistics. And this was in 2004-ish. So things may have changed a little bit since then. But the main branches of linguistics at that time were sociolinguistics and psycholinguistics. And the main difference between them was sociolinguistics said that culture forms the language, that where you live and how you live and what kind of geography you live in and what kind of people you live with determine how the language will develop. Psycholinguistics says that language develops out of the structure of the brain, that our brains, it's kind of nature and nurture is what it comes down to. Psycholinguistics is about nature and how our brains develop and how we inherently come up with grammatical rules. And it's not a societal, like society doesn't come up with these rules. We just develop them innately. And then sociolinguistics is like, no, it's culture. Culture has a huge influence. Well, you know what? It's both. But I love to see the connections between culture and language because there are so many. And whenever you read literature, you're always going to need to take into consideration the context for the literature, right? So if you read Russian literature like Tolstoy, Anna Karenina and Tolstoy were what I did my master's thesis on. So I knew a little bit about Tolstoy. But if you read Tolstoy, it really helps to understand the historical background of what's going on. So you know why he's making the points that he's making, the way that he has his characters act. And it's the same thing with any other literature with like Jane Austen, or Charles Dickens, or F. Scott Fitzgerald, any of those guys. Literature courses are always emphasizing how you need to understand the author's intent and his cultural background and anything that he or she might be drawing on from the culture. So some examples, a novel written in 2023, say if I wrote a novel or a friend wrote a novel, might have references to lockdowns and disease that someone writing in 1993 would not have, right? And we would all know exactly what we're talking about. We don't even need to mention the word pandemic to know that lockdowns because of disease, we all feel it already. But here's the thing. The Bible is literature too. It's divine, it's inspired, but it's literature. So if we really want to understand the nuances, the style, the structure, the particularities of the Bible, we should be willing to learn about the culture that made it and why they made it that way. So in the last episode, we learned about how Hebrew verbs are basically one-trick ponies that, which is, by the way, it's the same for a lot of Romance languages. And Romance languages are anything that is a descendant of Latin. So Spanish, French, Italian, they are the same where they have very specific verbs. And we have some of them in English, like enter, exit, board, board the boat, board a plane. Those words come from Latin, the ancestor of Spanish. English is actually not a Latin-based language. It's a Germanic language. So we have lots of Latin words, but we are Germanic in our grammar. So in Spanish, you can't say, I entered the room dancing. You can't put that together in one word. You can just say, I entered the room and I was dancing. A lot of Romance languages function the same way, where it's one-trick pony verbs, where they can only do one thing at a time. You can talk about direction or manner, how you came in, but you can't say both at the same time. So it's a way that English, because they can combine those two ideas, can allow for a lot of creativity and be efficient that way. Hebrew has to be creative in other ways and isn't as efficient in that one way. It is very efficient in other ways. So Hebrew verbs can express direction or manner, but not both. Right? That's what we talked about in the last episode. So now we're going to move on to the next way that Hebrew is different from English. And when I learned this one, I was fascinated. There's a lot of things that we can take for granted with a language. Some really, truly basic things that we think there's no way that can be different in another language. A modern example is I saw an Instagram reel. So this Instagram reel was about a woman that lived in India, and she was talking about how head nods, nodding of the head, didn't make sense to her until she realized that there were patterns and that different head nods meant different things. And I watched the whole video, and it was fascinating because it was true that there were head nods to mean yes, there were head nods to mean no, there were head nods, and they're all like generally nodding, not shaking the head. But they were so intricate. If you've lived in India, let me know if this is a widespread thing. Like, I'm just basing my information on an Instagram reel, so I don't know how specific to a region this might be, or if it's everywhere in India. But she showed like 5 different head nods and how they meant specific different things. And I had no idea. And it was like, wow. That's just a cultural thing I had no idea about. And now I actually respect head nods in a way that I didn't before. So that's a modern example of a way that maybe you didn't think about how head nods can mean such different things. Now, let's talk about this one. So that's head nods. That's body language, basically. Let's talk about verbally saying something. Try this. If someone asks you if you want to eat lunch, and you do, what do you say? And if somebody asks you if you want to eat lunch and you don't, what do you say? You might be thinking along the lines of, yes, that would be great, or no, thank you. But there's a lot of other ways that you can say it. If you wanted to say yes, you could also just say, that sounds nice. Or you could say, lunch would be good. Or you could say, I would like some lunch. Could also say, if they're thinking about making it themselves or they want to pay, you could maybe say, oh, if it wouldn't be a problem. Or you could say, I would, but do we have time? Or you could say, oh my goodness, I totally want Thai right now. If you'll notice, I didn't say yes in any of those answers, but all of those answers meant yes. Some of them with conditions, like do we have time? Or if it wouldn't be a problem, that's implying that you think it might be a problem. But none of those answers said yes. You can say yes, but you can also say a lot of other things. And every language has their own variety of ways to say yes or no in polite ways, blunt ways, kind of sidestepping the issue kind of ways. But what I didn't know before this year is that all languages fit into one of three categories of how to say basic yes and no, and that not all languages have a word for no. Now, for the following information, I'm ripping straight from my intermediate Hebrew grammar book. So you're learning from a grammar book. Here's what it had to say there. And I got more from other sources as well, but it was my Hebrew grammar book that told me this for the first time. There are generally three systems in the world for answering yes, no questions. So this is specifically for yes, no questions, not like how's the weather or what do you think about the current situation, but do you like this? Yes or no. Do you want this? Yes or no. So three different systems for answering yes, no questions. And I'll remind you that language systems generally in the world are on spectrums with things. That means that there's usually not extremes or absolutes with languages. There's almost always exceptions. So these are things that go almost always true. So like I said, with languages of the world, there are three systems for answering yes and no questions. One system, the first system, is like English, where we can just say yes or no. That means there is a word for yes and there's a word for no. And you can be simple if you want to be. You can be as simple as that. You can just say yes. That's just one system. The rest can just be extras in a way. Modern Hebrew is a yes-no language. It can just say yes and it can just say no. Another category that we're not going to get into too much is agreement-disagreement systems. We don't need to know much about that one because it just doesn't matter for the podcast. But that one can be a struggle to learn because it sounds complicated and contradictory to English speakers. One of the languages of the world that uses that, Japanese. The last system is the one that Welsh, Irish, Portuguese, and other languages, and Biblical Hebrew have. So in modern Irish and Portuguese, this is still true, and Biblical Hebrew, it's called an echo system. And we're going to look at some examples first, and then we'll talk about them. Here's an example. In Exodus 2:7, this is when baby Moses is floating out in the river. His mom is trying to save him from Pharaoh, who's trying to kill the baby boys. And Miriam, his sister, is watching out for him. He's floating in his little reed basket. And the princess, Pharaoh's daughter, finds baby Moses hanging out in the reeds. And she fishes him out. And then Miriam walks up. And what Miriam says in Hebrew is, "Shall I go and find a wet nurse for the baby?" And all that you get in the answer from Pharaoh's daughter is, "Go." Miriam says, "Shall I go?" Pharaoh's daughter says, "Go." I'll do another example before we talk about them. 1 Samuel 23:2. This is when David is not yet king, but he hears about an attack from the Philistines on the town of Keilah. And he's worried and he prays and he asks God, "Should I go and attack these Philistines?" And God says, "Go, attack the Philistines and save Keilah." So if this system of yes, no is echo, do you know what they're echoing? Can you tell what they're echoing? They're echoing, they're repeating back the verb, the action, or the main statement of the question. There's no yes in there because guess what? There's no yes in Biblical Hebrew. There's no word for it. They have a word for no, but they do not have a word for yes. Now you might be thinking, wait a second, I'm pretty sure I've read the word yes in the Old Testament. And so I thought about this. I'm like, I'm sure I've seen the word yes in the Old Testament, in the part of the Bible that is written in Hebrew. So I went and looked, and yes, yes, you have, but not in the King James Version. There is no yes. It does not exist in the King James Version of the Old Testament. It's not there at all. But if you look at, say, the NIV, yes is in the Old Testament 53 times. Still not very much. But I then looked in the NLT, which is a much more what you call dynamic translation, which means they're trying to get the idea more than the exact words. And there, it's a grand slam total of 275 times. So in the King James Bible, yes does not appear in the Old Testament. NLT, 275 times. So what I did was I looked up some of the places where it says yes, and I just wanted to see why do they have a yes in there? What are they doing? And it makes sense. They're not messing your Bible up. It's just that biblical Hebrew has a much different way of agreement than in English. And it comes down to translating literal words or translating concepts. You would think that yes and no would have pretty standard equivalents, yes and yes and no, but even that can't be taken for granted in language. So here's the question, why should you care? And I don't mind if you don't care about translation theories and formal equivalencies and all that kind of stuff, but if you do care, there's an episode for that. It's episode 17 from season 2. I have lots more information about English translations of the Bible in there. So season 2, episode 17, if you're interested. But for us here, why should we care about this yes-no system, echo answer system? Well, here's the thing. Because of such a thing as connotation and mood and how things sound and what we kind of put back into the Bible because of how it sounds in English. So we're going to go back to those examples and talk about what does it sound like, okay? So Exodus 2:7, Miriam asks Pharaoh's daughter if she should go get a wet nurse for baby Moses, and the princess simply responds with, go. Now, in English, especially in American culture, unless you're a part of a kind of more blunt subculture, and I was thinking what's really blunt in the U.S., Brooklyn. I think in Brooklyn, you don't really chit-chat a whole lot. You just kind of get straight to the point. But in English, in American culture other than Brooklyn, generally speaking, to just say, go, sounds pretty rude, pretty abrupt. You could start to think, if you're not from Brooklyn and you speak English, you could start to think of the princess as being kind of stuck up, kind of rude, kind of spoiled, maybe used to getting her own way. And she kind of just turns her face up and says, go, you know, you can imagine. And I didn't realize that I had kind of a bit of that perception of Pharaoh's daughter when we already know that she's sympathetic and kind. She's adopting a baby that she fished out of the river. You can't be cold-hearted if you're fishing a baby out of the river and adopting it as your own. And in the Bible, it does say that Moses was brought up as her own child. She's not unsympathetic. She is kind. But that kind of answer of just go can seem really cold, right? And it's just because of that answer, just because of that one word. But in Hebrew, because that's what it's written in, that's exactly how she should have responded. There was no better way. She did not have the word yes. She had go, because it's an ecosystem. You repeat back what the person asked, and that means yes. Okay, so let's go to the Keilah one. 1 Samuel 23:22. When David asks God if he, David, should go attack Keilah, he says, should I go and attack Keilah? And God says, go and attack it. So when I read that, when I hear that in my head, God kind of sounds impersonal and authoritative. And that's kind of it. Go and attack Keilah. Like it sounds so automatic, kind of robotic in a way. Should I go and attack Keilah? Go and attack Keilah. That's how I imagine it. It's almost like maybe God is just either super impersonal, kind of robotic, or almost irritated, like, go and attack Keilah. Like, go already. Stop asking me questions. And is it that how it should sound to me? After reading about yes, no questions, I definitely don't think so. Now that I know how yes, no questions are done in Hebrew, I realize the way God answers those exact words says nothing about his relationship or state of mind with David. So my focus can shift from how he answers to what he answers. and the fact that he answers at all, right? Shouldn't that be more cool that he's answering? He's giving a very specific answer to David rather than me being irritated with how he answers. So here's one more example for you. And this one is from 2 Samuel 12. And this is after Bathsheba and David had their affair, and Bathsheba gets pregnant, and David kills off Bathsheba's husband Uriah. And Nathan the prophet comes to David and convicts him and tells him that the baby that he and Bathsheba are going to have is going to die. And when the baby is born, David goes and like starts fasting and praying and puts on sackcloth. He goes the whole nine yards, and because the baby is sick, and he's praying that the baby will get better. And finally, the baby dies, and the servants, David's servants, are kind of like hiding in the shadows in the hallway because they don't want to have to tell David that the baby died, because they're kind of afraid that he's going to like start going crazy, something. Because they're afraid that if he was that distraught when the baby was still alive, oh no, what is he going to do when the baby is dead? So this is the scene, 2 Samuel 12, 18 to 19. It says, "On the seventh day, the child died. And the servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they said, 'Behold, while the child was yet alive, we spoke to him, and he did not listen to us. How then can we say to him, the child is dead? He may do himself some harm.' But when David saw that his servants were whispering together, David understood that the child was dead. And David said to his servants, 'Is the child dead?' And they said, 'He is dead.'" This is from the ESV, by the way. In other translations, they put a yes in there. But the ESV decided to be more literal and just put "he is dead," which is what it is in Hebrew. Now, when you're talking to somebody who you're afraid is going to harm themselves because their child just died, and he says, is he dead? And you just kind of blurt out, "He's dead." That seems pretty cold. Like, that seems very ungentle, not very diplomatic, not trying to be careful or considerate of his feelings, right? That's how I felt. Just, "He's dead." Why? Because of the ecosystem, that was their option. That was how they could say yes. It wasn't them being blunt or harsh. It was them using the language option that they had. And that's it. So hopefully you can see why this can be important. If you're like me, who you pay attention to the words, the kind of words that people use, and you can sometimes be bothered by the way people say things, or super pragmatic people, and you can think of them as either rude or impersonal or domineering or formal. If you don't think like me, this stuff might not have bothered you at all. So it's just some information to tuck into your back pocket, because we will talk about it in the last episode for the season. It'll come up and it'll be pretty important. But if someone like Abraham, or Moses, or Daniel, or Jacob, or Esther, or Boaz, or anyone else in the Old Testament ever sounded rude, or stuck up, or undiplomatic, or anything like that, you might want to think about why. And if the way they answered yes-no questions was a part of that, now you know what to do with it. All right? So just one more tool to stick in your pocket to understanding why the Bible is written the way it is, why different translations differ on how they write things, why yes never appears in the Old Testament in the King James Bible, and why it's in there over 200 times in the New Living Translation. Just some stuff to help you out. I hope you guys have a great day, and I'll talk to you again the next time. Bye.